Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where Mark Tedeschi makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's well known to many of you. Before I formally introduce him, I should thank our chairman, Nick Johnson, who thought this would be a good idea, and I think it is a good idea to have Mark here today. So I'll introduce him very briefly. Of course, he has a high profile. Mark Tedeschi, QC, is Senior Crown Prosecutor for New South Wales. He's practiced at the coalface of criminal courts for 38 years, both for the prosecution and for the defence. His first book, Eugenia, was shortlisted for the Australian Book Industry Awards and the Ned Kelly Award for True Crime. And tonight, Mark Tedeschi, QC, is going to speak for us on Kidnapping for Ransom, the Graham Thorns Tragedy. Mark, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you very much, Nick, also for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be here. We are particularly fortunate in Australia that the crime of kidnapping of children for ransom is almost unknown. In fact, the kidnapping of Graham Thorne in 1960 by Stephen Bradley was, to my knowledge, the only case in Australia. There are other countries around the world, including some in our part of the world, where that crime is much more prevalent. I hope that it will always be as it is in Australia. There will be some of you who are here tonight who would remember the kidnapping of Graham Thorne. Anyone who was the age of about 6 or 7 and above, and in Australia at that time, would remember the case vividly because it gripped Australia for about 9 months. It was front page news for about 9 months. And it was a case that in many important respects changed Australia. Two important respects that I'll mention to you. Firstly, before the kidnapping of Graham Thorne, Australian parents would quite readily allow their children to play unsupervised in the streets, in parks, in nearby bushland. After the kidnapping of Graham Thorne, parents were very much aware of stranger danger and would insist on their children being supervised to a much greater degree. I've had numerous people at talks that I've given about the book say to me that their childhood changed with the kidnapping of Graham Thorne. Another change, and perhaps from the point of view of our legal system a more important change, was that the police threw enormous resources at this case to try and solve it. And in particular, they engaged in techniques of forensic science that had never been used before. Techniques that today are quite commonplace. So this case really marked the beginning of modern day forensic science in Australia. And in the book I describe in some detail those techniques that were used. So I'll give you a very brief rundown of what happened for those of you who either weren't around or don't remember. Graham's parents, Basil and Frieda Thorne, had won first prize in one of the early Opera House lotteries. They had won £100,000. It might not sound like a lot today, but if you consider that the average house price in Sydney and Melbourne in 1960 was £8,000, you could buy 12 ordinary houses for the winning prize money. There was no such thing as a concept of privacy in those days. The official notices of the winners was published in all the papers, and not only was their name publicised, but their address. And if you had somebody's name and address, you could ring up the telephone exchange and get their phone number. So it was very easy for the kidnapper, Stephen Bradley, to find out all that he needed to find out about the Thorne family. He had seen a photograph of Basil Thorne in the newspaper holding his winning ticket. Stephen Bradley had seen the photograph in the Sydney Morning Herald. At the time, he was in dire financial straits. He'd been employed by a life insurance company. There'd been what he categorised as a misunderstanding when some insurance premiums that he'd collected hadn't found their way to the insurance company, and he'd lost his job. Whilst he'd been employed, he'd bought a very expensive house in Clontarf with a loan from the insurance company. So when he lost his job, he and his wife and their three children were in dire financial straits. It was in that situation that he saw this photograph of Basil Thorne, and about a week later, he read an article in one of the weekly magazines about some popular or some well-known kidnappings that had occurred overseas. It was an Australian magazine, and it was written in the way of saying, well, this is the sort of thing that happens to people overseas. It doesn't happen in Australia. Stephen Bradley thought, well, it wouldn't be hard for me to emulate some of these kidnappings, and he decided that he would kidnap the 8-year-old son in the Thorne family, Graham, whose picture is there. If we go to the next photograph, that's Basil and Frieda Thorne. And the next one, Basil and Frieda lived very modest lives. They were typical working class Australians. They had trouble making ends meet. Basil was working as a travelling salesman, which was an occupation that was fast disappearing even in 1960. And they rented the downstairs flat in that modest building in Bondi. Opposite that building was a big park, so it was a very easy matter for Stephen Bradley to conduct surveillance of the Thorne family home and their comings and goings. And he worked out very quickly that Graham would, every school morning, would walk down the street where they lived to a nearby corner store. He would purchase a packet of chips, sit on his school case and wait for a lady who would pick him up together with two other boys who were in the same uniform. In fact, he went to Scots College in Bellevue Hill. His parents struggled to pay the fees to send him to the Scots College. But it was a family tradition. Most of the males in the family had been to Scots. That's a photograph of Frieda with Graham's younger sister, Belinda. Now, the next photograph is the one I wanted to show you. That's a photograph of Basil holding his winning ticket, the one that was published in the papers. And it was that incensed Stephen Bradley, because he thought how unfair it was that he and Magda were struggling, and this man had won this fabulous prize through no merit of his own. And in a way, he was possessed with this sense of entitlement, that he was of superior ability to most of the people that he knew. He was of superior intelligence. He was a man, he thought, who could see opportunities that others would miss. And he thought it was just grossly unfair that he and Magda hadn't received the wealth that he felt they deserved. The reality was he was considerably deluded, and he thought that he could plan a kidnapping and foresee every possible eventuality that might happen. And he was utterly convinced that, like with one of the kidnappings that was described in the weekly magazine that he'd read, that he could conduct this kidnapping so that within 24 hours it would all be over. the boy would be safely home with his family, really only almost unaware of what had happened. The parents, yes, they'd be upset about it, and they'd be a bit upset to lose £25,000, which was going to be his ransom demand. They'd be a bit upset, but when their child was returned, everything would be fine, and he and Magda would be able to live the lives that they deserved. Well, in every respect, he was totally deluded. On the day of the kidnapping, he used his own car. He was undisguised. He parked his car on a corner where Graham would have to walk right past where he was parked to get to this shop. And being parked right on the corner, there just happened to be another car that came past. As Stephen was getting out of the car, and the driver of the car thought, what a strange place for someone to park, and he noticed the car and the driver. Unluckily, Stephen Bradley, the man in the car, whose name was Cecil Denmead, was an absolute aficionado for cars, and he was able to describe the make, the model and the colour with utter precision after the kidnapping. Anyway, I describe in the book how Stephen Bradley managed to get Graham into the car and what I think happened afterwards. What we know for a fact is that Stephen Bradley drove his car with Graham in it and made the first ransom call from a public telephone box near the Spit Bridge near Mossman. Before that time, he converted what was a voluntary lift into a forced abduction. And I enter into some hypothesis as to how he converted that lift into an abduction. When he made the ransom call, he thought that Graham's parents would think that he was truanting or doing something that he shouldn't be doing or whatever. Again, he was totally deluded. By that stage, Frieda already knew that her son hadn't arrived at school. She was already absolutely bereft with worry, knowing that her son would not have played truant or done anything that he shouldn't have been doing. He was a particularly obedient and compliant boy. She'd already rung the Bondi police station. A police sergeant had already arrived at their home and was taking down details of Graham when the phone rang. Frieda raced to the phone, answered it, hoping that it was the school saying that Graham had arrived, but no, it was a man who said, "Is that you, Mrs. Thorne?" "Yes." "Is your husband at home?" "Why?" "I have your son." She then handed the phone over in horror to the police sergeant, who pretended to be Basil Thorne, but unfortunately, he was probably the only person in the whole of Sydney who didn't know that this Thorne family had won first prize in the lottery. So when the man on the other end of the phone said, "I want you to get together £25,000 as a ransom for your son, and I'll ring you back at 5 o'clock to tell you what to do with it," this poor police sergeant said some words that he was later to deeply regret. He said to him words to this effect, "How on earth do you expect me to get money like that together in that short time?" To which Stephen Bradley replied, "If you don't have it ready, I'll feed him to the sharks." Now, we're used to headlines today about shark attacks, but let me tell you, in the 1950s and 60s, there were many more shark attacks, not just in the northern part of the state, but actually around Sydney, than there are today. So it was a very potent threat. That night, Basil Thorne went on national television to plead for the life of his son, and he was prepared to pay any amount of ransom to get his son back. If we could have a look at a couple more photographs. This is the official notice of the Opera House Lottery win. This is Stephen Bradley. This is his wife Magda. This is a photograph of Stephen and Magda and their children in happier times. This is a photograph of Stephen's impressive house in Clontarf, which he'd bought with the loan from the insurance company. This is a view from the park looking down at the Thorns rented flat on the left. This is the corner store where Graham would go each school day. This is the car with which Stephen Bradley abducted Graham Thorne. It was a blue 1955 Ford Custom Line, and he bought it especially for the kidnapping because it had a large boot which he used as a makeshift prison for his victim. This is the route that Graham took to get down to the shop. When the kidnapping was announced that very day, the police launched a massive investigation and canvassing of houses in the area, and this is a photograph of some of the detectives walking around. This is the newspaper the following day, but in fact on the day of the kidnapping, the afternoon papers already had details of the kidnapping. And this is Basil Thorne immediately after the broadcast where he was pleading with the kidnapper or kidnappers for the life of his son. Now, Basil and Frieda waited valiantly by their phone for the 5 o'clock call, but it never came. In fact, the call came at 9:47 p.m., unbeknown to Basil and Frieda, unbeknown to the police, unbeknown to the whole of Australia, who already knew about this kidnapping. Graham Thorne was already dead. I look at the evidence in the book about exactly how he came to die and why he came to die. Stephen Bradley, in his call at 9:47, was making a last valiant attempt to get the ransom money, even though he knew he couldn't produce a live victim. And there was another police officer who answered the phone. He realised it was a different voice. He knew that the police could trace phone calls. He made the call from just a couple of kilometres away from his own home. And so when the policeman tried to stall for time, he swore in Hungarian, which was his native language, and hung up. Stephen Bradley had made egregious mistakes. He attempted to call the Thorns before the kidnapping, but their phone was not connected. So he actually went up to their front door one night at 7 p.m. and knocked on their front door to find out why their phone wasn't connected, thinking that if he waited about 3 weeks, they'd forget about him, they wouldn't remember what he looked like, they wouldn't remember that he had a fairly strong Hungarian accent, and thinking that they'd never connect it to the kidnapping. Of course, he was deluded. By the time he made the call at 9:47 p.m, he had already discarded Graham's school case and cap along the Wakehurst Parkway near French's Forest, which is a very heavily bushy area. And then on the way back to his home at Clontarf, he disposed of Graham's body on a vacant block of land in Seaforth. In those days, people had no idea about trace evidence like we do today. Today we would know that you can just touch something and you might well leave some trace evidence. But in those days, people didn't know that. And when Stephen Bradley left Graham Thorne's body on the vacant block of land in Seaforth, he very carelessly left with the body a silk scarf of his own that was wrapped around the boy's neck and a picnic rug that was wrapped around the boy's body. And it was from these items and Graham's clothing that the police, or really forensic scientists, at the instigation of the police, managed to get a tremendous amount of trace evidence and information about the person who was responsible for the kidnapping. So by the time, by October of 1960, and the kidnapping was in July, so what was September, 3 months later, 3 months after the kidnapping, the police already knew the following information about the kidnapper. He had access to a 1955 blue Ford Custom Line. He had a foreign accent. He had access to a house where there were two types of cypress tree. One type of cypress was very common, but the other kind was very rare. And, in all probability, this building where Graham had been during the course of the kidnapping had foundations made with pink and white mortar. They also knew that this family had a dog, most probably a Pekingese, and there was a woman in the family who used a particular type of red henna rinse. So that's quite a bit of information, isn't it? Now, the police searched for a house of that kind for weeks and weeks and weeks without any success. And finally, in desperation, they decided to focus on the area where the body and the school case had been found. And they went to a mail exchange at Balgala and spoke to all the postmen who delivered the mail. And they showed them photographs of the two types of cypress tree. And they told them about the pink and white mortar. And they told them, please, on your rounds, when you're delivering the mail, keep an eye out for a house that has these three features. That very afternoon, an observant postman saw a house in Moore Street at Clontarf that he thought had all those three features. So he called the police. The police called the head of the Botanical Gardens to come and inspect the cypress trees, and yes, they were correct. And the police then made inquiries as to who was living in that place. Well, there was a new owner. And the new owner had taken possession of that house 2 days after the kidnapping. And the previous occupant had left on the very day of the kidnapping. So they made inquiries about the man who'd moved out on that day, and they found out he was an immigrant, he had a strong accent, and the family had a Pekingese dog, his wife used a red henna rinse, and he owned a 1955 blue Ford Custom Line. The police had already interviewed Stephen Bradley. The reason why was that when the police worked out that they thought that Mr. Cecil Denmead had given them an accurate account of the car that had been used, the police embarked upon an exercise the likes of which had never occurred in the history of policing throughout Australia. They decided to interview every single owner of a car of that kind. But they decided they couldn't rely upon the colour being blue, because no rational kidnapper would have used their own car. So what they were looking for was clearly a car that had been borrowed or stolen. And the borrower or the thief would no doubt have changed the colour of the car. So they had to interview all of the owners of any colour of that type of car. And amongst other owners, they interviewed Stephen Bradley and they asked him a whole series of questions that had been formulated by the police. Was your car in your possession on this particular day? Yes, said Stephen Bradley. Was it lent to anybody? No. Was it stolen at around that time? No. Where was your car on that day? In the garage. Thank you. Tick, 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 tick. Just another one of the many owners who had been checked and excluded from the investigation by the police. So in some respects, the police went off on the wrong track. They also, for many weeks, didn't focus on the area around where the body had been found, thinking that no rational kidnapper would leave the body anywhere near where they were located. But Stephen Bradley was a very lazy criminal. If he had the choice of doing something near to his home or far away, he'd choose near to his home, because he was so utterly convinced that there was nothing that could link him to this crime. And of course he was deluded. But by the time the police had identified Stephen Bradley as the kidnapper, Stephen, his wife Magda and their three children had left Australia on the P&O liner the Himalaya, bound for England. And when he was identified, they were on the high seas in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The next port of call was Colombo. So the police got an international arrest warrant for Stephen Bradley in Colombo. He was taken off the boat. His wife and their children continued on their journey and ended up in London. And Stephen Bradley was then subject to extradition proceedings. Now you can imagine that for the 3 months after the kidnapping, when the police investigation was underway, this case was constantly the subject of media attention. When Stephen Bradley was identified and taken off the ship in Colombo, there was even more publicity in the media. And his extradition proceedings were covered every day in the media. And then his return to Australia. And then he faced committal proceedings and trial in Sydney. Now, he was in jail for quite a few weeks in Colombo. And he had quite a bit of time to think about what he was going to say and do. And he was provided with a copy of the police brief, which I got a copy of. And he realised that there was a very strong case against him for his involvement in the kidnapping. So initially he decided he was going to confess to the kidnapping, but suggest to the police that the death of Graham Thorne had occurred through no fault of his own, and it was a complete accident. And he was fortified in this approach by the fact that at that time, to the horror of the police and the politicians, there was no crime of kidnapping in Australia. We hadn't needed it. There hadn't been a crime of kidnapping of a child. So there was no crime of kidnapping for ransom. And if the boy hadn't have died, there would have been some minor abduction charge that the police would have had to prefer against him. But of course, Stephen Bradley went to trial on a charge of murder. His initial approach was that he confessed to the kidnapping. He was then remanded in custody in Long Bay Jail. And within a very short period of time, he was disabused of the fact that he could avoid responsibility for the death, because there was a category of murder known as reckless indifference to human life. And the circumstances in which Graham had come to die, even if they were not directly caused by Stephen Bradley, which in my view they were, it was, but even so, Stephen Bradley realised that he stood to be convicted of murder on this category of reckless indifference to human life. So he very quickly changed his story, and by the time he came to trial, no, he was not involved in the kidnapping at all, and the written confession that he'd done to the police had been extorted from him, because the police threatened that unless he confessed, and they dictated the confession to him, unless he wrote it out using the words that they said, that they would get straight on a plane, go to London and arrest Magda and bring her back to Sydney, charge her also with the kidnapping, and their three children would be placed in an orphanage or something like that. So he said, in desperation to try and prevent that from happening, he just wrote out the confession using the words that the police said. So he went to trial claiming that the confession had been extorted from him, that he was totally innocent of the kidnapping and the murder. He gave a doc statement and gave evidence. So he was cross-examined by the Crown Prosecutor, who was my predecessor, the senior Crown Prosecutor. And there were only two people in the courtroom who thought that Stephen Bradley would be acquitted. One of them was Stephen Bradley, again because of his deluded mind. And the other one was his counsel, his barrister, who was the public defender of the day, a man by the name of Fred Vizard, who was a very, very good public defender. But he was the kind of man who would believe whatever his client told him, and he firmly believed that his client was innocent. Well, when the jury came back with a conviction, there was literally dancing in the streets outside the courthouse. The whole of Australia rejoiced because the case against Stephen Bradley was just so overwhelming. The only sentence that was available for murder in those days was life, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. Life, of course, in those days didn't necessarily mean life. It's not like it is today. But if you want to find out what happened to Stephen Bradley after his life sentence, you'll have to read the book. So that's a bit an overview of the book. One of the reasons why I wrote it is that I found the personality of Stephen Bradley and his wife Magda, their personalities, just so interesting. What would convince a man who was a family man, who had children of his own, one of whom was almost the same age as Graham, what would make him commit such a horrible crime? What would make him what would enable him to bring about the circumstances in which Graham came to die? And Magda, at the time of the trial, most of the media, and therefore most of the public, thought that Magda was probably involved as well. And I enter into an analysis of whether or not I think that Magda was involved. And I came to the conclusion that I think she was not involved beforehand, but within a very short period of time, after the kidnapping was publicised, which was on the afternoon of the kidnapping, she was up in Queensland with the children. I think very soon after the kidnapping, she had this terrible thought that her husband may well be responsible for the kidnapping, and yet desperately, desperately hoped that she was wrong, and thought to herself, I just cannot believe that the man that I'm married to, the man I've been living with, could possibly commit such a horrid crime. But both of them were fascinating characters, and the stuff that, you know, people write about in fiction, but sometimes true crime is more fantastic than fiction, and I think that is the case in this particular case. So that's a very basic outline of what is quite an involved story. And having given you that, I'll just show you a few more photographs. That's a reward notice from the police department. That's a reward notice from one of the newspapers. That's the scene at the memorial to, I think it's Lord Wakehurst or Lady Wakehurst on the Wakehurst Parkway, where the school case was found. When the school case was found, Graham's lunch was still in his lunchbox, and that was the apple which his mother had lovingly peeled and placed the peel back round the apple so that it wouldn't brown for his lunch, and it was still intact. And so when they found that, they thought, the police thought, things are not looking very good for Graham. There was an incredible search of the bushland on both sides of the Wakehurst Parkway, an enormous number of police, soldiers and indeed civilians joined the search. And that's some of the searches along the Wakehurst Parkway. That's the vacant block is on the left of that house. There's a rock there under which the body was placed. And that's the area under the rock where the body was found. It was found by 2 6-year-olds who were playing there for some days. They called it the fort. And they thought it was so exciting that there was a skeleton under the fort. And it was only after about 3 or 4 days that one of them mentioned it to his 8-year-old brother, who the extra 2 years of maturity made him be suspicious, and he mentioned it to his mother, who mentioned it to the father, and that night they went and found the body and called the police. That's the Sydney Morning Herald notifying the public about the finding of the body. That's the funeral for Graham Thorne at St Mark's at Darling Point. That's the rug that was found. That's the rug being inspected by its manufacturers in Adelaide. And that's the garage of Stephen Bradley's home, where he parked his car and imprisoned Graham in the boot. That's the garage, and the it's the entrance to the area under the foundations. It's called an alcove, and that's where Graham's body was laid to rest before he disposed of the body, and how it came to have the flecks of mortar on the clothing and the rug. That's Magda, and the rug. It was a negative that was found, which helped the police to link Stephen Bradley with the kidnapping. That's the piano line of the Himalaya. That's Stephen Bradley being arrested in Colombo. That's the extradition proceedings in Colombo. That's the boot. That's the courthouse at Darlinghurst, where Stephen Bradley was tried, and I myself have done numerous trials in that courtroom in the centre of that building. Until about 20 years ago, every single murder trial occurred in that courtroom. There was a huge queue of people every day trying to get into the trial. It was enormously popular with the public. And this is the crowd trying to get in on the night that the jury announced their verdict. Now, it was a very, very long trial for its day. It was one of the longest trials that had ever occurred in Australia up until that time. It went for 8 days. If you had a similar trial today, it would go for somewhere between 3 and 6 months. That's Fred Vizard, the defence counsel. That's Magda, and that's Frieda and Basil leaving court after giving evidence. That's Magda going to Long Bay after she returned from London to visit Stephen the day before the trial started. That's the announcement of the conviction and life sentence. And that's Stephen Bradley in jail, his jail photograph. That's a memorial to Graham at the Macquarie Cemetery. And that's it.
So thanks to Mark Tedeschi for a fine performance, and we go to questions and discussion. I should also say that, of course, Mark's here on the occasion of the publication of his book, Kidnapped, the crime that shocked the nation, and we've got Janet Grundy's got a copy of the books here, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them after the event. So we've got to the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. Just starting off, you spoke, you indicated the numerous errors that Bradley made, and you spoke of him as being delusional, but I wonder whether he may not have just been overconfident. I mean, you make this point in the book, but a friend of Van and mine, Hugo Wolfson, was a German Jewish Australian who was at Melbourne University as an academic in the 50s, and another academic who I think had a Hungarian background was Franz Laszlo. You know, this is in your book. Now, Wolfson told me later that Laszlo would, through the 50s, would say time and time again at lunches and gatherings that Bradley killed his daughter, who was Bradley's second wife, and everyone thought he was mad, obsessive, crazy, deluded, until the Thorne case, when suddenly people thought perhaps he did. And the question is, and I know you've canvassed the issue, there is pretty suspicious circumstances around the death of Bradley's second wife, isn't there? And maybe he just thought you could murder people in this country and get away with it.
Yes, there was a lot of conjecture about that. Stephen Bradley had been married 3 times. Magda was his 3rd wife. He'd been married in Europe the 1st time. He then came to Australia in 1950 and married another child of an immigrant. Mr. Frank Laszlo was the father of his 2nd wife. He was a lecturer in engineering at Melbourne University. And when they got married, Frank Laszlo settled on his daughter a nice house in Melbourne. And about 3 years after they were married, Stephen Bradley convinced his wife, her name was Eva, to transfer the house into their joint names. And within a few months, she died in a car accident where her brakes mysteriously failed. The police were never able to establish exactly why the brakes had failed, so there wasn't enough evidence to charge anyone. But as you say, Gerard, Frank Laszlo was utterly convinced that his daughter had been murdered. He maintained it for the rest of his life. And you're quite right that people would kind of poo-poo it, really, for many years until Stephen Bradley was exposed as the kidnapper of Graham Thorne, and then people started to take it more seriously. Because, of course, the death of Eva resulted in the property being transferred wholly to Stephen. So there was an incentive, there was a motive.
Right, so question here? Yeah.
What improvements in the police processes do you think eventuated from the Graham Thorne kidnapping?
It was the very first time that the police used what's called the running sheet system. So it was an organised way of recording every piece of information that was received from the public, and then what investigations were done subsequently. Because it was so extensively published, there was an enormous amount of information that came in, and every single bit of it had to be checked out. And of course, 99% of it was useless. So it tied up an enormous amount of police resources. And what the police weren't aware of is that one of the dangers of this running sheet system is that you get hordes and hordes of paper with nobody kind of having an overview. So there were actually 2 neighbours who provided some very valuable information to the police that was just discarded, never followed up. Just filed in the running sheet. So the police over the years have learnt that's a risk, and to this day they try to engage in various methods to avoid that sort of thing. They're constantly reviewing information, getting people with a fresh eye to review information so that doesn't happen, because after a while the police who are doggedly pursuing an investigation day after day, they tend to become a bit jaded, they lose sight of some things, and that they lose their objectivity, and a fresh pair of eyes can sometimes see the significance where other people can't see it. But the size of the investigation was unparalleled. The number of police involved, the number of scientists, the people they went to the extent they went to try and locate the car, every aspect of the case was unheralded.
I seem to remember he died in Goulburn Jail as a result of a heart attack he had during a table tennis game. I don't know whether it's true or not, but did you find he sort of was miserable in jail, or suffered any remorse?
The question is whether Bradley was miserable in jail in Goulburn, whether he ever suffered remorse for his crime.
When Stephen Bradley first went to jail, the jail authorities placed him in strict segregation because of the nature of the crime. They thought he was very much at risk of being harmed by other prisoners. However, he had such an engaging personality. He was so likeable. Everybody liked him. And within a matter of months, he was the most popular prisoner at Goulburn Jail. So he was no longer kept in segregation.
This question there, yes.
You said we didn't have a crime of kidnapping, and that would presumably be up to the states. That was true of all states, presumably.
I think
and
it was.
How did it change? Yes. Presumably it isn't so now.
The media and the public clamoured for the politicians to pass laws immediately and retrospectively. The Premier of New South Wales, the then Premier, Mr Heffron, and the Leader of the Opposition wisely decided that they shouldn't do it immediately. They should wait until the case had been completed and then pass legislation. So it wasn't done in haste. It was done properly and in a considered manner. So it wasn't until after the trial that laws were passed to bring in the crime of kidnapping for advantage.
And in other states?
Look, I'm pretty sure that there weren't laws in the other states as well, and they very soon followed suit.
Squish down the back.
Did they stop publicising the personal details of what it is?
They did. They initially gave people the option of writing NFP, not for publication, on their lottery application form. But then afterwards it just became almost unknown for the winners of lotteries to have their identities disclosed. Yeah. But I was giving a talk about a week ago and somebody got up and said that his Italian uncle, who had come to Australia about 10 years before the kidnapping, won one of the later lotteries and won a fantastic sum of money. And he said that within 3 weeks, he'd left Australia and gone back to live in Italy because he was so fearful that his young daughter would be kidnapped. So, you know, people were so fearful if they won any sort of big money of a copycat crime.
Question. What happened to the thorns?
The thorns.
What happened to the thorns is the question.
Yeah. The thorns moved house. They stayed in Sydney. They tried as best they could to give their daughter Belinda a normal life and not to have this albatross around her neck. But inevitably, it affected both parents for the rest of their lives. When Basil died, it was either in the late 70s or early 80s. 78, was it? It was said that he died from a broken heart. I mean, how do you get over something like that? Frieda lived much longer. She only died about 3 or 4 years ago.
There's a question over there. Yes?
Is there not a common law crime of extortion or kidnapping?
The question is whether it was a Commonwealth crime of extortion.
My mother did win the lottery a couple of years later. I was 10, we couldn't open it, we weren't allowed to open the door.
Okay, so for those of you here, his mother won the lottery some years later and they weren't allowed to open the door. So there are 2 points. One, was there a Commonwealth crime? Well, that's one point.
Common law crime. There were statutory offences of abduction at that time, but it was not a particularly serious offence. It was a much more minor offence than kidnapping. So it wouldn't have been sufficient to match the gravity of the crime. It would have been an offence, but not a suitable offence.
OK, we'll take another question.
Seeing you're a senior prosecutor now, when you researched the book, did you find any difference in the way trials were conducted then, back in 61, as to how they are now?
Absolutely. The main one was, during the trial, they stuck to the point. every question was a pointed question that went somewhere. The case was a very complex case. There was a lot of science there. There were lots of witnesses, eyewitnesses, and the parents, and it was a very varied, broad case. They were getting through a dozen witnesses a day, and the addresses took, I don't know, an hour or two, and the jury took a couple of hours, including dinner.
There's a question down the back. Yes?
Bradley appeals to the Court of Appeal, but it seems from reading the judgments of Chief Justice Abbott and the other two judges, Clancy, it was a very perfunctory appeal. I mean, the appeal judges could barely contain their contempt for the man and How dare you appeal?
It's a question about the appeal to the New South Wales Court of Appeal.
The appeal was also done by Fred Vizard. He raised some issues that hadn't been raised at the trial and was given short shrift for that by the Court of Criminal Appeal. The Court of Criminal Appeal even today doesn't like matters being raised that haven't been raised in the trial. But look, the evidence against Stephen Bradley was so overwhelming that, like the jury, the appeal judges felt that it was a hopeless appeal, and during the course of submissions, Fred Vizard actually told one of the judges that, in effect, you've already made up your mind. That's not fair. He didn't say it in those words, but that's what it meant, you know, with the greatest of respect. And yes, they gave him short shrift in their judgment. It was, in fact, they basically said that any jury that failed to convict would be derelict in their duty as citizens with the oath that they'd taken.
Fred. Yes.
My mother had a cousin called Dr. Lillian Fraser. Now, Lillian Clay, she was the one who named that pine because it was the only one in that particular street in Fontaine.
Did you hear
that, or is it a family law?
Well, it's a question of who named a pine in a street in Clontarf. It might be the second book, I think. I think it's a bit tricky, Fred. There's a question, Peter.
Yeah. Did Stephen Bradley ever acknowledge to anyone, a fellow prisoner or anyone at all, that he did this crime?
Did Bradley ever acknowledge his guilt?
No, Stephen Bradley never acknowledged his guilt after his first confession to the police. Never said anything in jail, always denied responsibility, never showed an ounce of remorse for the crime or for the death, and protested his innocence till his dying day.
Why were the little boys allowed to wander around when there's a kidnapper on the loose? Age 6.
So there's a question about the 6-year-olds who found the body. I mean, their parents just let them? It was a next door block, wasn't it?
Look, they lived in the street. I don't think they lived in that house next door. It was just in the street. Look, I think it was a gradual process that parents tightened up on their kids, particularly after the body was found. And of course, those kids were playing on the rock before the body was found. But yeah, I mean, that was typical of what kids in that day and age, were allowed to do.
Have we got any of the other question here? There's one there. Yeah.
Yes. Was it possible for the forensics to identify the cause of death afterwards?
Was it possible for forensics to identify the cause of death?
It was. Pathologist who did the post-mortem examination gave evidence and was cross-examined, and the cause of death is discussed in the book. It was very well done, the autopsy. I don't think there'd be any more that a pathologist would be able to tell you today about a body in a similar situation.
Second last question down there.
How much time has elapsed from
especially the elapse of time from the death to the discovery of the body?
5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Yes. It had, and one of the things that they got the experts to do was to look at various parts of his body and clothing to try and ascertain how long he'd been deceased. And they looked at things like mould that had grown on the soles of his shoes and on his socks, and you know, the condition of his stomach contents and things like that.
Just a final question. A lot of facts in this book, as you would expect from someone in your position, but there's also a bit of supposition. You've gone beyond the facts to come up with some kind of suggestions about how certain people may have felt at certain times. So it's a factual book, but it's also got your opinion in it. explain that way of writing crime history.
Yeah. It's a genre which I'm particularly attracted to, and thank goodness my publishers Simon and Schuster are also interested in. It's called creative nonfiction, and what it means is that you stick very clearly with the facts when the facts are known, but where you try and give some life to the personalities involved and to try and work out what their motives must have been, what their thoughts must have been, and where the facts are unknown, if there are enough surrounding circumstances that enable you to work out what you think must have happened, then that's something that you include in a book where you're writing in this genre. And what I found is that particular aspect of it, the creative parts of the writing, are the most satisfying parts to write. It's obviously very different to what happens in court, where you can't be at all creative, you're stuck with the evidence as it is. Whereas in a book like this, and the same with my first book, Eugenia, one can enter into conjecture based upon the evidence that's known.
Many thanks.
Thank you, Jerry.
It's been great to have Mark Tedeschi along here at the Sydney Institute of the Gallipoli Club on the occasion of the publication of his second book in this genre, Kidnap, the Crime That Shocked the Nation. As I said, there are copies of that available. But I think it's also important for us to remember tonight that if Graham Thorne hadn't been murdered, he'd be a man in his mid-60s, probably living around Sydney. This was a terribly sad case, and those of us who remember us when we were young, I can still recall it vividly. I remember reading all the newspapers about it. And I think it's so important that Mark has put the facts together in a book, because it's a very significant case, and we should be thinking about the victims at this time as well. So I'm very pleased you've done it. I'm sure you'll be doing more in this genre, and we'd love to have you back again. But for tonight, on this occasion, congratulations and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.